So what do we have? Two mics there, huh? Okay. Cordless ones? Okay. So who of the commissioners wants to start off here? Anybody? Oh, they're going to have me do it. All right. Well, I have a question, so I'm going to get things going here. Mr. Vickery, there you are. When you were talking, and I think I probably missed something here. When you were talking about the value of regenerating clear cuts for bicknell thrush habitat, is altitude a factor there? I mean, because it's a subalpine.
Altitude, first of all, this is an area that hasn't been studied in great depth. There are a couple of research papers out from New Brunswick. Altitude probably is a contributing factor. So let's just say a clear cut at the lowest elevation in this area, which I'm going to guess is 1,800 feet. Bicknell thrushes may not come down to that. But the amount of habitat that has been cut in close proximity to the 2,700-foot area, I can't tell you the exact altitude where bicknell thrushes have been found in this region. And Dana might be able to give that answer, but there's no doubt that what we saw yesterday is within the range of where bicknell thrushes will go. I mean, there's no absolute about why they, wouldn't go down 300, 500 feet if the habitat is available and in proximity to what exists in the area.
Okay.
And I would just add that over 27,000, I think it's 20 or 22,000 acres of habitat has been cut over the 2,700-foot threshold in Maine. That's actually since 1974 from LURC records.
Okay. Do you want to?
Would you like me to
comment on that just briefly?
Yes. Yes. I'm Dana Valu.
Can't hear.
So my name is Dana Valu, and I work for TRC Engineers in Augusta, Maine. We did do surveys at some lower elevations related to the Kibbe project, and we found bicknell thrush in relatively recent cuts, 12-year-old cuts below 2,700 feet, but between 2,500 and 2,600 feet in elevation. And looking at modeling done by the Vermont Center for Eco Studies, formerly the Vermont Institute of Natural Sciences, their model is based somewhat on elevation and latitude. So in this latitude, their model shows habitat potential from about 2,500 to 2,600 feet and up. So there's certainly potential and available habitat below 2,700 feet in this area. And as you go further north in the state, that elevation comes down.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you. Ed, go ahead.
I also have a couple of questions for Mr. Vickery. And again, perhaps it's directed to the wrong person, but it was your testimony. You identified through a number of vistas, photographs, what you considered to be potential habitat based on clear cutting.
Yep.
Have you actually surveyed that area to determine if there is a presence of bicknell thrush?
Well, I know a few areas have been surveyed, but I'm going to pass.
So you didn't do the survey?
TRC did actually do some surveys, yes. So
okay,
I'll pass
so
this
the,
over
the
to
areas,
Dana.
The areas of potential habitat that you identified, those the sweeping vistas, are in fact habitated by the big no.
Let me pass that over to Dana.
As part of the Kibbe project, we looked at all of the areas that actually were in Peter's photos, and we had breeding bicknell's thrush in one of those areas. And folks we were working with, Biodiversity Research Institute, actually did some misnetting, and they did capture a female thrush in breeding condition with a brood patch in that cut. And it was a 12-year-old cut right directly adjacent to Goldbrook Road.
As the cuts age, as new growth takes place, does the habitat move?
Yes. These birds are mostly in the very dense, thick growth. So, you know, at the higher elevations of the subalpine fir, they're in the dense and stunted growth, which shifts and changes depending on natural events like ice damage and wind throw, similar to how a clear cut will, you know, regenerate the natural ice throws, eliminate tree growth, regeneration comes in, it becomes suitable for bicknell's thrush, and as it, the density of the trees thins out, the canopy height increases, bicknell's thrush will move into other areas that are younger or smaller growth.
So as the land is cut over time, the habitat for bicknell thrush will diminish as well as increase. Is that not correct?
Right. And that's kind of the natural paradigm for the bird, too, is the higher areas of subalpine habitat shift and change over time.
Okay. So the areas over which none of us have any control, to identify them as potential habitat to reflect de minimis or minimal impact of this project may be a little speculative. Is that not correct?
Yeah.
Well, I think the way I would put it is that, and I think I tried to explain this, Peter Vickery, is that as the forestry practices shift, one area is cut, and you could see in one area where there was snow cover, and that's a more recent cut. That is not going to be habitat this in the next 3 to 5 years, but 7 to 12 to 14 years down the road, it will
right.
be. So I think what I would say is that the high quality habitat in regenerating forest is shifting in
right.
in space and time,
mm-hmm.
And really the single quantitative study that was done on regenerating clear cuts was done in New Brunswick. And they found bicknell's thrush, and I can't give you the elevation, but it was not terribly high. I think they found bicknell's thrushes on, if I can read this, 57 out of 90 point counts. You know, the point count is where you go and mm-hmm. listen, and then you go down the... So over 50% of the point counts in that study had bicknell's thrush in it. I think, again, it was either 11 to 14-year-old regenerating forests. So... there's pretty convincing evidence that these birds will use that for a range of time.
Assuming that current forest practices continue as presently exercised.
Correct. And my point was that as of today, in 2010, there's more habitat, or at least I think there's more habitat available now than there was 100 years ago.
So there could be less tomorrow.
There could be less, well, not tomorrow, but 50 years from now or some.
Right.
Yes, if the forest practices change,
right.
then that structure that regenerating forest is likely to change.
I also wanted to ask you a question. This is more of, I think, a conceptual question. We got lots of testimony regarding impact on resources, and you made an interesting sort of intellectual argument, and that is that because the wintering habitat, the loss of forest cover and predation, there are fewer bicknell thrush. That's the big issue. And because there are fewer bicknell thrush, we probably don't need as much habitat. And particularly for, I forget, which you, the, you referenced a New Hampshire study which indicates that breeding area, there's actually more of it because they're dying in the Caribbean, and therefore we should be less concerned about affecting breeding area. And also, habitat seems to me to be an interesting discussion. Your discussion also of climate change. I mean, we also, as a species, went through the ice age, and we rebounded. And quite frankly, as we as a species, I question the extent to which we are going to be able to adapt readily to a major climate change. And to assume somehow that because they've done it before and they're going to do it again, that it won't stress the species seems to me to be a rather interesting way for a person who studies the Bicknell thrush to view their value.
I'm certainly didn't indicate, I don't think, that climate change won't be a stressor. I think it will. And I think the Bicknell's thrush will move and its range will change in response to climate change. My point is that this species has faced acute challenges in the past and has responded by moving in space and time. I have no doubt that they'll do the same thing. Will it be a stressor? Yes. Can they adapt to that? I think for sure. And the point is that if the one image I showed with sort of the islands in the sky, the high subalpine areas where Bicknell's thrushes are known to breed, disappear or diminish because of climate change, the bird is out of luck. And I think there's no evidence to suggest that. And if you look at, you can't look ahead in time in terms of what will happen, but you can certainly look back in time, and that's what I've done, saying that entire present breeding range was under ice. But the bird certainly managed and adapted to that situation. So will climate change be a stressor? Yes. Do I think this species has the flexibility to adjust to that? I think the answer to that, in my view, is yes. Now, to get back to your first point about removing 8 acres or so of prime habitat up in this latitude, in the present breeding range, doesn't seem to be as important. And the answer is, it is not as important. When 75 to 90 or 95% of the wintering range is gone, there is a lot of available habitat. And I was frankly interested when I reviewed the point counts that TRC and others did, that Bicknell's thrush wasn't more widely distributed down the Sisk range because of that subalpine habitat that continues further south. And in my experience, going back 30, 35 years ago, I think we probably would have seen some Bicknell's thrushes in that kind of habitat. And the population is declining, not only documented in the New Hampshire study, but I think in a number of other areas as well. That doesn't have to do with the habitat here.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Anybody else? Rebecca?
I have some questions for Mr. Vickering as well. They sort of parallel what Ed was saying. What is your background with Bicknell's thrush? Is it more of an interest, or have you actually conducted studies on your own, at the PhD level, or?
No, I haven't done published research on Bicknell's thrush. But starting, I think, about 35 years ago, I spent time visiting a number of different mountains, and I have since then trying to figure out the distribution of Bicknell's thrush. I've been to eastern Maine. They used to occur in the low stunted forests of Washington County, right along the coast. They no longer do, or at least apparently they don't any longer occur there. But I spent time looking for them there. So I haven't conducted field work, and it is a remarkably challenging species to work with. And I have to give enormous credit to the folks in Vermont who've carried this on. And frankly, they're the one of the only groups that have really worked intensively on this, and that's, I know Chris Rimmer very well, and I appreciate and admire his fortitude. I'm not sure I admire his good judgment. It's just a killer bird to work with. So no, I haven't done any, as I say, published research or on Bicknell's thrush.
Now, the Bicknell's thrush was identified as its own species not 35 years ago, but sometime in the fairly recent past, I understand.
Yeah, there's a paper written by a Canadian, Henri Ouellette, in, I think, 1993, that documented reasons why he thought Bicknell's thrush should be separated from gray-cheeked thrush. So when I was looking in the 70s, we called this bird gray-cheeked thrush. I mean, it's the same bird, it's just got a new name.
Okay.
But we knew it was of interest because of its restricted range in Maine and in the Northeast way back then.
From what we understand, we've been presented with information about the impacts of climate change on the forest in Maine, and this apparently modeling suggests that there's going to be a tremendous reduction in the fur amount in the state within the next 70 to 100 years. And you keep talking about the Bicknells being able to move somewhere else, and I'm just wondering where they could possibly go. If we're one of the we're a northern corner of the country,
we're in the northern.
But then the other piece of it is, okay, and I think it gets back to what Ed was suggesting, is we're talking about the ice age and they've been able to rebound, but the human effects on the environment and potential habitat have changed dramatically. I mean, it's comparing what I would say apples to oranges today. Their ability to adapt not only to climate change but a severe reduction in habitat and human activity. I guess I question some of your conclusions because they're interesting, but yeah. I'm not sure. And without having done a study yourself, I'm just...
Well,
is it conjecture?
It's interesting to think that we're at the northern end of the country, and we are in terms of the Northeast in Maine. But, of course, we have our neighbors to the north, and Bicknell's thrush breed throughout the Gaspé. They breed on the north shore of the St. Lawrence River in Quebec. And so they occupy those habitats already. And as I think Don has pointed out, the amount of subalpine habitat further north is abundant. Now, they don't presently breed in some of those areas, but there's no reason to think that they won't be able to adjust and to shift to that. It's not as if they're trapped on the Maine border. And if the sites in Maine disappear, the game is over. They breed north of us in some substantial numbers, and there's no reason to think that they wouldn't continue to shift north given the loss of spruce fir in this area.
Anybody else? Steve?
I'd like to shift to the capacity, the installed capacity, and the projected capacity. Probably, if you followed the commission, the first permits we granted were based on blind faith, and we weren't even allowed access to the Met Tower data because it was confidential and corporate, kind of a corporate secret. But we were always looking forward to the time when we could find out if indeed the installed capacity was what it was presented to us. So I know the A-Series hasn't been online long, but there's a few things I'd like to... Its installed capacity was advertised, or we permitted at 132, and it says the production is 120. Am I missing something there, or is that information we have access to now?
Sure, sorry, just to clarify, that the 120,000 megawatt hours is for the Kibby expansion project, the 45 megawatt project. Kibby project itself, once fully operational, will produce about 350,000 megawatt hours a year. So the number quoted on the bottom of the slide, I think it was three. relates to the 45 megawatt expansion.
I'm misreading that. The page 3 and 4. Okay, the existing, so it's approximate and synergistic to the 132 megawatt Kibbe project. So we still don't have, obviously both are not online yet, but we still don't have the numbers for that for production then, right?
Well, I mean, we've got a few months of production data from the first phase of the Kibbe project.
Yeah.
I think the numbers, we've produced roughly about 51,000 megawatt hours between November and the middle of April. If you adjust that to a sort of a capacity factor, that's a little over 29%.
Okay.
Our long-term forecast for the Kibbe project was just a little over 30%
yeah.
capacity
okay.
factor. So broadly speaking, we're in line with,
okay,
with the expectations.
I'm misunderstanding. Secondly, to the taxation and the financial... To the taxation and the financial benefits. The first project, we were presented with property tax figures, and that was later overridden by a TIF, which was beyond our control, obviously. Are you going to request a TIF should this project be approved?
My understanding, there's a moratorium on TIFs in the unorganized territory right now, so
okay.
it sort of precludes that.
Well, yeah, if that was lifted, pardon me? Yeah. Okay. Well, if you were able to, would you apply for a TIF?
The reason we applied for the TIF on the Kibbe project itself was because of the timing of the approvals, our costs started to creep up significantly on the Kibbe project. And so to help offset some of those costs, we went for the TIF. In the end, only part of that project was TIFed. We're actually just finalizing our assessed value for the Kibbe project today. We'll actually pay more in property taxes than we projected back when we were going through the Kibbe project itself because of the cost increases, even with the TIF. So, I mean, I guess I'd say, obviously with the moratorium, we're not planning on a TIF, but if cost increases, happen on this project, and the moratorium was lifted, and we think we need that TIF to make the project, financially stronger, perhaps. But I mean, no immediate plans.
I guess, in the interest of disclosure, that would be, I think, should be a part of the financial implications. Instead of just pure property taxes, it should be qualified with the fact that a TIF may be in the offing, or we would consider a TIF. That's just, I don't know how the rest of the commission feels, but I was taken by surprise by the first TIF. Property taxes are borne, the landowner transfers the property, you're leasing the land. Okay. So that's under tree growth now. And it's removed from tree growth once the property taxes are transferred to TransCanada? Okay, thank you.
I have a question that's similar. As you know, at these hearings, we get a lot of conflicting testimony and a number of times there's been the issue raised of the contributions or the benefits, financial benefits provided by these projects. And then we also get the testimony that says, yes, but they're heavily subsidized by taxpayer dollars and it's coming out of our pockets and the only people or the only entities that are benefiting financially are really the stockholders or the owners of the company. So the same figure that Steve was just talking about, $40 million derived from state income taxes and local property taxes over 25 years. How much in terms of the subsidies or the taxpayer dollars that are making this project feasible, how does that compare to the $40 million that's coming back in property taxes? Like, what is this really costing taxpayers versus how much is coming back to the taxpayers in property taxes? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So in most of the programs that support renewable energy are federal programs, not state programs. So the extent that we're getting, you want to call it subsidies, it's federal subsidies. So I think Maine benefits when you build wind projects in Maine, because you get everybody across the nation, more or less paying for those subsidies, including TransCanada when it pays its taxes here. And then it goes to support the benefits stay in Maine. So I think it's a good deal for Maine to build wind projects.
But what is the good deal? I mean, what are the numbers? Seriously, that's what I'm trying to get at. Because I pay federal and state taxes, and so I'm helping to support, or we're all sort of subsidizing this particular industry, and it's great to get a number like $40 million is coming back to Maine, but how much is it really costing? When you look at the real cost of one of these projects to the people, the working people, what's the real benefit?
There's a temporary program as part of the stimulation bill that allows renewable projects to claim a cash grant in lieu of the PTCs that were still available. And that's equal to 30% of the qualified property cost of a project, which is not the full cost of the project. So, if this project was $100 million, we'd probably get like $25 million in a grant back from the federal government.
I would just like to support, I think, the thrust of what both Rebecca and Steve are saying with regard to the financial package as presented. I'd like to see it refined a little bit because, quite frankly, I felt a little betrayed when I found out that Kibbe, after presentations at public hearing and representations before the commission, sought a TIF in order to support their project. In your demonstration of financial capacity, in your demonstration of public benefit, there was discussion of what the both gross and net financial contributions would be, and it turned out that they were not accurate.
And just to take issue with that, again, we are paying more in property taxes than we stated in the Kibbe hearing. We said we'd pay roughly $1 million of property taxes over the life.
But
with the TIF today, we're going to pay over $1 million in property taxes.
But you also suggested that if your financial estimates, which you have presented to us as accurate, are variable, and you have the opportunity, you may in fact seek another TIF. Wasn't that your testimony just a few minutes ago?
I mean, I think it's a good thing for everybody if the project is strong and economically viable. If cost increases that are beyond our control happen to us, we look for ways to mitigate those costs, to keep the project financially strong. And that's exactly what happened on Kibbe. The capital costs of the project increased largely as a result of equipment cost increases. At the time of the hearing, we didn't even know TIF was possible in the NRA's territory. So it wasn't even in our heads. But as a result of the capital cost increases, I have a duty as a TransCanada employee to look for ways of keeping that project strong. And we we heard the announcement on the Stetson project that got a TIF, and we thought, well,
right,
this is a way to sort of offset some of the increased capital costs, benefit the local community through the TIF program.
I think all we're asking, we understand that, certainly. I think everybody understands that unforeseen costs, those types of things, obviously modify calculations. But I think what we would like to know is when you present data to us, financial data, how confident are you in that data? I mean, what might be some of the variables that would affect changes in those estimations? And also, I mean, the question of a TIF is also, there are issues with regard to shifting tax burdens in the state of Maine with regard to TIFs in general. And I mean, there are larger issues over which you have no control and shouldn't be held accountable. I don't mean that, but the issue of seeking a TIF for a project like this If that's your intention, I think it would be we would feel better. I would feel better, and I'm assuming at least two other commissioners would feel better if we knew that up front and could sort of ratchet down.
I can state very clearly today, we have no intention of seeking a TIF given the capital cost of the project that we project today.
Today.
No, we don't order our equipment until we have the permit. There's, a length of time between that and between today and that time period. I mean, we're under active discussions with turbine suppliers and our balance of plant contractors and everything else. We don't control their costs, so if they change their prices between now and then to the point where the project becomes questionable from an economic standpoint, right? I mean, I can't preclude every possibility going out in the future. But staying here today, if these capital costs, we think we've got them quantified fairly well, barring some unexpected moves. But, I think we can, there's no intention today of seeking a TIF.
Thank you.